This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson and welcome to this extra episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Recently, we were invited to HMS Heron by Philip Richardson, who's the commander of 815 Naval Air Station based at HMS Heron, which of course is the air station at Yeovilton. We were invited along to celebrate the success and the retirement of the Western Lynx from Fleet Air Arms Service. This is due to take place on the 31st of March 2017. At this event, we had the opportunity to talk to Commander Richardson and some of his colleagues about the Lynx and about the service that is delivered over the last 40 odd years, some of the stories they've got and some of the experiences they've had. This episode doesn't feature technically a lot about the aircraft, more about how it served the Fleet Air Arm. So I hope you enjoy it. Let's get started by hearing Commander Gus Carney, who is the Lynx Wildcat Maritime Force Commander. Then we get to hear from Commander Phil Richardson.
So I'm going to start by introducing Commander Phil Richardson, who's the commanding officer of 815 Squadron, who is just on his way in.
Now. Good morning, everyone. Hello. I've actually brought a friend with me, Gus Carney. A very good morning and welcome to 815. I'll just let Gus give a couple of words.
Quick warm welcome to myself. I'm the Force Commander, so what does that mean? I own the bigger train set, both 825 in its training capacity on the Wildcat now. Also, the Wildcat's here and the Lynx as they go out of service. And then I run the Force HQ. So we're a big group of 500 people together on this force. But I will be, and am, the last Lynx Wildcat Force Commander. And I changed my name to Wildcat Force Commander as of 31st of March, as these guys changed their name to Wildcat Helicopter Squadrons. So a real warm welcome. What does it mean to us as the Lynx go out of service? Well, she is our proven weapon carrier that the RN's had in the last 40 years. She's been through several conflicts and she has taken the destruction to the enemy and has been the last real proven air-to-surface missile system that we've used in anger, taking it through the first Gulf War. And hopefully you might meet some of those guys who fired those weapons later in the day. The Lynx continues in its various guises by the users across the world, which just shows how popular it is. But within the Navy, there's certainly been a move and there's more Wildcat out on dispersal than there is Lynx. But the Lynx is a really impressive piece of machinery that's kept us going this long, and I would continue flying. I've just been doing my last ever sortie in the Lynx simulator with my two brothers, who ironically won a raffle prize to fly in it, even though I own it. And just been flying in that. It's great to get back in there. I fly the Wildcat now, but I've just got back into the Lynx, and it feels like a glove. You know, we've worn it on our backs for the last 15 years in my case, for the guys you'll meet later a lot longer, and it's a real piece of history for British defence, one that will continue but one that will hopefully not be lost to us, because we've got a gate guardian that will remain outside and it will hopefully have interaction with the museum, but we are your last advocates really within the surface flotilla that will talk to you about it, unless you go across to those that are using it. So I'll hand you over to Phil, as it is his baby and it's his day, but I hope you enjoy it. So thank you again, I'll see you later. Thanks,
Gus. Well, Gus has already mentioned that it's a key aircraft for us in the Fleet Air Arm and the Royal Navy for 40 years. And there are plenty of people who, if you were to cut them in half, would bleed Lynx OM-15 hydraulic fluid or F-34 aviation fuel. But although you say that tongue-in-cheek, I have been, and from a personal perspective, inundated with a huge amount of goodwill and following of people who are not just serving now, who've been working with the aircraft, but lots and lots of people who, over the 40 years, when the Lynx has been based down at RNAS Portland, HMS Osprey, before it came up here, the people that really wanted to come say goodbye to it. So there is definitely an emotional attachment to this aircraft, and it is one that has served the Royal Navy for 40 years in an extremely impressive way. And if you just play a video in the background, I just want to talk to you about some of the main qualities that the Lynx has given us. Now, you can see here that this is, you may well have seen it, it's a video on YouTube, but it's a Lynx doing some deck landing trials out in the North Sea, and it is a particularly difficult day, but with the pitch and roll movement of the deck, you'll see that the aircraft will land safely. I'll ruin the end of the video, but that's because the design of the aircraft by Westlands, all British aircraft that was manufactured, is absolutely ideally suited to the maritime environment. Now, if you can imagine doing this at night, which is what we do on a day-to-day basis when we're away at sea, and having salt water thrown all over you and being rather cold, that's the environment where the aircraft lives and works. And that is, sadly, over the horizon, because when we operate from here, all we're seeing is training or practicing for doing this at sea. And that is where the people who you'll meet today will share some of their experiences of what we do. So he's actually just waited for a quieter period where the deck slowly moves less. And then you'll see as it lands on now, the underneath the aircraft right here, there's a harpoon. It goes into the deck and it acts like a hydraulic ram and pulls the aircraft onto the deck. That's unique to the Lynx, the Naval Lynx helicopter. And the other thing that was designed into it was that the fact it's got a very low centre of gravity, that it's very responsive with a fixed titanium head, means that the aircraft has got a lot of movement, dynamic movement, quick movement around the deck, which is what you need to do to operate safely. And also it's got the ability to give sort of blow the aircraft onto the deck as well, so negative pitch on the blades, which is absolutely what you need in a maritime environment. So designed by Westlands, okay, and eminently suitable for the Navy and maritime operations, hugely successful because it's been sold all the way around the world by many different nations, and lots of different nations are continuing to use it with younger versions of the aircraft. We have got the last seven here on in the Royal Navy inventory on 815, but we are a squadron now that is in transition. So we have got the last 2 months now of operating the Lynx alongside the Wildcat. So come the 31st of March, the last Lynx will have been taken out of service and we will be an all Wildcat squadron. So at the moment, we're a 50% Wildcat with seven Wildcat aircraft and the seven Lynx. The last Lynx flight, which is 208 flight, which is embarked in HMS Portland at the moment, they're away on a 9-month deployment. They've been in the Arabian Gulf and out in the South Atlantic, and they will be coming back on the 10th of March for their final disembarkation. And that is a big moment for us as we welcome that crew back. Every other flight which we're supporting and parenting from here is a Wildcat flight at the moment, which is away at sea, and from then on we'll all be Wildcat. So I come back to my first point. It's an emotional attachment I would offer that most people have, and hopefully what you get today, some photographs, some stills and some interviews will reflect what I've said.
We then retired to the crew room, where Commander Richardson told us the story of the 2005 ditching of a Mark 8 Lynx.
I knew what was happening. I knew what to experience, and I was very calm.
Do you have a dinghy pack on you?
Yeah, yeah. So you sit on there. They reckoned that was what snagged me. So the barrel, the PSP connector through the Martin Baker clip that you clipped into. It's a 12-inch lanyard, and as you pull yourself out of the aircraft, they think that that's what snagged on something that stopped me getting out.
Did you bring the stas up with you? Did you suck it dry?
No, I didn't suck it dry. I got to the surface. I took two rather large breaths, and I took a large proportion of it, but I was then very conscious. It was just after sunrise, so as I was conscious, I was very deep. I didn't want to take too much because I knew I had to blow out all the way up. So I managed to get up to the surface, and I probably had about half the stas left.
Did you lose both engines at the same time? Were you feeding fuel when you were running out of fuel?
No, we still had about 40 kgs of fuel left, and the engines flame out at 30. So what I didn't want to do was be flying along and for the aircraft just to run out of fuel and just spang it in. So I thought we need to make this a controlled ditch. So it was just flying it slowly into the water. And in fact, as I went into the water the first time, a wave came over the front of the cockpit, and I was, because all the air intakes are up there, I was still flying, but looking underwater, I thought, this is just wrong. This is crazy. I can see fish and I'm flying. So I just pulled in power and I actually got airborne again. But I then looked at the fuel gauge and it was almost on zero. I thought, I do not want to run out of fuel and fall into the water. So
could you contact? Would people know where you were?
I'd put out a mayday call, and that had been acknowledged by the aircraft that had been controlling us, so they knew that we were ditching. Yeah, but it was all, the whole sortie was MCON silent. It was, you know, putting the jets into Afghanistan in the really early days, and so we didn't want to announce where we were. But when things started going wrong, we went out on guard and transmitted and escort emergency and all the good things that you need to do. No. Well, the tanker, which as it transpired that the ship that they were giving us as range and bearing to, was a great big liquid petroleum gas tanker with all sorts of pipe work all over it, and it would have been a complete firework had we landed on there and the thing would have exploded. So they saw the first two people jumping out of the aircraft next to them, because I came into the hover next to their ship, and so the eyes came out on stalks as they came out onto the bridge wing, and they did a big turn and came back, and it took them about 45 minutes to do that. So they were the first people on the scene to help us, but at the same time the search and rescue aircraft from the aircraft carrier had been launched, and they came on top about an hour later, and they winched us up and took us back to the aircraft carrier.
Were you worried about embolisms and stuff? How deep do you reckon you were by the time you
reckon 60-70 feet? Pretty deep.
Did you get decompressed?
No, I didn't. I mean, I was blowing all the way up, and to be honest, I was confident I wasn't. I felt all right. They didn't actually ask about that, but they asked how deep I was. And the only way I could judge how deep I was, because underwater, I could see the length of the links, and I just extrapolated, well, I'm about 2.5 lengths of the links deep, which is about 60 feet.
Did it turn upside down? Because it goes down like a stone, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. So it goes down, and it turns upside down initially. I shouldn't really be telling you before you're about to go out flying, but because the doors were all open, the aircraft filled immediately. You should do, but my door didn't jettison it ended up being sort of halfway across my knee, so I knew that was I had to get over that. But it turns upside down, and then with all the weight on a Lynx at the nose with the radar and the PID, it goes nose down, and it just goes. So I'm lucky to be here, definitely.
How deep was it?
Well, 60 to 70 feet, they reckon, but that was what they looked at in the investigation, and that's what they interpreted for how long I was underwater for, and what from my description of what I remember.
I've got a lovely picture actually of the aircraft 3 days before when I was on Nottingham.
Did you?
Yeah.
I'd love to see it. Yeah. I'll show you my logbook, because my takeoffs.
Quite a nice nose up, didn't you, on it?
Yeah, we did. Yeah, Strongbow was the call sign. So we phoned up Strongbow, and they'd sent us crates and crates of cider, and so we'd given that to the flight, and we'd all had Strongbow for a long time before we left, and yeah, it was rather embarrassing when, you know, Strongbow's no longer here. It's down at the bottom of the ocean. But yeah, if you look in my logbook now, on the 5th of March 2005, I've got a takeoff, I haven't got a landing, and I've got about 5 minutes of solo links time, which is no one flies the link solo, but everyone had jumped out and I was flying solo, so that was a unique logbook entry. Yeah. It is, and there's a reason why we don't, and Lucky Al will tell you why. Is because there was a formation flight that was, we used to, and two links were flying in formation, and one of the links was doing his checks as a single pilot, and he looked down and they had a tip strike, and because he drifted too close, so he landed. Thank goodness the guy survived, and he's still on the squadron now, and he's called Lucky Al for a reason. So, and that's Al Reed, and you'll see him this afternoon.
We then retired to the hangar. We'll get to speak to Lucky Al a little later. But we carried on talking to Commander Richardson about the differences between the Lynx and the Wildcat.
It's common between the Lynx and the Wildcat.
Quite a lot, actually. Yeah, so the design of the Wildcat is obviously based on the Lynx. And all those things I was saying earlier about the ability to take the maritime characteristics and the suitability of it to work in a rough sea environment, they're translated straight into the Wildcat. The low CFG, the wide undercarriage and the robust oleos, all of that is, you can see it's a similar shape, but it's a very different aircraft. So the avionics, the sensors, the weapon systems, everything else is different.
It's a new generation.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're going to have a look inside the cockpit and you won't recognise one from the other at all.
And what was the transition like in terms of training and piloting skills?
Long and bloody. No, it's we looked really carefully on how we wanted to do the transition, in that did we want it to be a steep loss of capability where we just stop everything for a year and retrain everyone, or do we want to do a shallow bathtub? And actually we've done it somewhere in between, where we've kept all our commitments to operations going at the moment, but we're also retraining people from Lynx to Wildcat,
right?
And that's taking that whole transition process will take 3 years, and we're not out of it yet. We'll need another year after we finish flying Lynx altogether before we're all Wildcat trained.
Okay. And you've got an unusual career. You didn't start off flying, did you?
No, I started off on board ships. I was a officer of the watch, gunnery officer, correspondence officer, and spent my time looking in the flight deck camera, looking at all those aviators down the back end having a great time. I thought, I'm in the wrong job here. So I re-specialised and went through Lynx flying training for 2.5 years, and then popped out as a GL aviator, which is a generalist aviator, so someone who's done much more time driving ships around at the beginning of their career. And I've always hopped between flying and the surface fleet in between, so I've had the best of both worlds.
And what's your best flying experience? We've just heard about a rather challenging one where you didn't make a landing after a takeoff.
The best flying experience, I would offer doing a casualty evacuation from the middle of a really rough sea state in the Mediterranean, and getting back to the ship after 2-3 hours on task, and knowing that we'd made a real difference. But the sea was really, really rough. It was a small Type 42 flight deck, a really challenging landing. actually the satisfaction of bringing the aircraft and all the people back safely was my most satisfying experience.
And you've served pretty much all around the world, haven't you?
Yes, in almost every theatre, Far East, South Atlantic, Caribbean, Middle East, Baltic. I haven't done the Pacific, so they can send me to Hawaii. That'd be nice.
And what about some of those colder climbs? Talk about South Atlantic and Baltic and that sort of thing. Of course, the Lynx has got a reputation for durability. What's it like flying in those sorts of conditions?
Well, apart from the fact there is no air conditioning in there, you have to wrap up warm and you put your immersion suit on and your several layers underneath. It does mean that you become slightly less dexterous within the cockpit, and it's harder to climb in and out, but it's worth the sweat if you're going to get wet. And we always wrap up warm and prepare for any eventuality. So we are, you're flying in much more challenging conditions. So South Atlantic, the seas are always much higher, much bigger. Winds are always windy down there. So 30, 40 knots of wind is normal. And you know, just operating, getting the aircraft out of the hangar, onto the flight deck, spreading it and launching in a sea state where the back of the ship is going 30, 40 foot in the air and down again, and with waves crashing over the side, is a real challenge.
Yeah.
But we have learned how to do that, and we are experts at it, and we maintain our expertise by being at sea and putting ourselves in those environments.
And how does one train for that difficulty? We saw the video earlier of the deck literally going not only up and down but side to side as well. I mean, how do you train to actually do the first one of those?
It all starts not far from here in the South Coast exercise areas, so off Portland Bill, where the seas, you can get pretty big sea states down there, 4 or 5, and we do our deck landing training through the training squadron initially, and then there is a currency which we are required to maintain to keep those perishable skills. So we need to make sure that we are always deck current to be able to embark at any time.
And is that a bit like in the olden days and what we're going to see in the future, the carrier landings? Is that what the pilots all have as their sort of proficiency test, ultimately landing on a live deck?
Yeah, absolutely. They will need to do a certain number of deck landings, but the simulators now are so high quality and the synthetic training is that good that actually some of our deck landing currency can be mitigated by doing deck landings in a simulator.
And in terms of the future, it's exciting times. We've got the Wildcat, of course, coming on stream, and we've got two carriers coming on stream as well. How exciting is that for you?
Enormously so. I have been on board HMS Ark Royal for 2 years as part of my career, and I've seen fast jet aviation take place, Royal Navy pilots flying from Royal Naval decks with the Harriers, and to be part of that capability is hugely exciting, and Wildcat has a role there with the reconnaissance and ISTAR capability that it has. We are working to integrate that within the carrier strike task group.
So next we ask Commander Richardson about the state of the current Lynx force and 815 squadron.
So we've got 250 people on the squadron at the moment. We've got 7 Lynx aircraft, 7 Wildcat aircraft, and with 2 months to go to the end of Lynx, we are replacing those aircraft with Wildcat all the time. So as we transition to Wildcat, we are changing the qualifications of our Lynx maintainers into Wildcat engineers, and that's a long process of doing that with new qualifications and procedures they need to learn. But the challenge at the moment is to run those two aircraft types simultaneously next door to each other, and you can see in the hangar here, Lynx goes down this side, Wildcat down the other side, and never do the two engineering procedures meet because there are different greases, oils, procedures that are required for both types of aircraft. So we have kept it completely separate, but we run them concurrently.
So what's the the transition for a crew on a Lynx across to a Wildcat? I mean, can you talk through?
Yep. It's 6 months. So the actual flying side of it, so the sticks and poles, it, if you drive a car, you can still drive another car, but you need to know how to start it, you need to know how to operate it, and crucially, you need to know how to fight it. Because ultimately, we're talking about a weapon system here, and the observer's role, which in a Lynx is to fight that aircraft, is exactly the same, but he's got a whole new suite of next generation sensors, and it's how they employ those is a long and challenging course, because you're a system manager much more so than perhaps in a Lynx. So the role of a Lynx versus a Wildcat in that is very different. You are low level in a Lynx and you've got a weapon system on the side of the aircraft, the sea skewer, and you would be used as a probe asset to go around and get a collect the recognised maritime picture, yet on the Wildcat you are collating that picture and then you are sending that to another unit which can prosecute it, or indeed when FASGW comes into service, that will then have the weapon system on the Wildcat so it can find, fix, strike all in itself.
How many hours have you got on the Lynx?
2,400 altogether. Coming up to 2 years. So April 15 I took over from my predecessor, and I have until the 11th of May when I hand over to my successor.
What's your next
step? Unknown at the moment, but I am most likely to go up to the Ministry of Defence in London and work in an engagements role there, looking at how relationships with the Royal Navy and countries abroad.
Affect your flying status when you get, in effect, a desk job? Do you get the opportunity to keep your flying hours going?
No. My flying will cease when I leave this squadron. The requirement to stay current is 15 hours per month, and that is impossible to be able to do that at the same time as doing another job elsewhere. So the level of readiness and the currency of this squadron we maintain is very high, because we are deployable at short notice, and we need to keep those skills. As I showed you, flying to a deck, they need to be kept honed, because it is a very perishable skill.
You're going to miss it?
Hugely. I will have a... there won't be a dry eye in my house when we decommission the Lynx. It's an amazing job, but my role is that I'm not one of the line pilots to go to sea. I deal with the management of the other pilots, the generation of them, the career management, and to check that they're safe, because we've got 16 flights on 815 now that are going up to all different corners of the world, and they operate completely independently, and it's on my assurance that they can operate safely. And there's a huge amount of responsibility on young shoulders here.
Yeah.
But we have really high quality people coming through, and I'm delighted to say that I haven't ever had any concerns with any of ours, because the training that we get is very, very good.
Okay, thank you very much.
That's all right, no problem.
So thank you very much there to Commander Phil Richardson, who started flying the Lynx back in 2003 and has 2,400 hours on type. He is, of course, the commanding officer of 815 Naval Air Squadron, but he also has been the senior pilot at 815, the flight commander on HMS Cornwall, where he worked and was deployed in the Baltic and the Gulf. And of course, we heard about the ditching of the HMS Nottingham Lynx.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
Next, we go on to meet Lieutenant Rich Bell, who has been flying the Lynx since 2006, has 2,200 hours on the aircraft, and it's very close to his heart. The first thing we talk to him about, what's it like to deploy to some of these disaster hit areas, and what is it like to fly in those conditions?
And we met with their disaster relief committee and spoke to the government. And the mandate of the Atlantic Patrol Task North ship is to be at a hurricane hit area within 48 hours. So it sounds like we're hurricane chasing, which we are. It's not as the conditions aren't as hostile as you'd think. Once the hurricane's gone through, we usually get quite calm seas. So we got to Nassau. We immediately did a long range survey up to Freeport, which was right at the limits of our endurance. We were flying about an hour and ten to get there, an hour and ten on the way back with a full crew of government officials. And when we got to the airport at Freeport, and the same in Nassau, all the light aircraft were upside down. They'd just been flipped over, buildings ruined. It was the damage was quite extensive, but on the main islands, the support was relatively good because they're used to this. Places like Andros, out to the west, that was about 40 miles away. They had no contact whatsoever. They have an airport there, but because all the airports were closed, it was a little bit of a free-for-all. There were quite a lot of Americans flying in from Florida with aid, just off their own backs, and also more established voluntary organisations. But we had one radio frequency and lots of people in the air. So I do remember calling finals for 1-8 at one point, and someone said, oh, we're on finals for 3-6. So no, you can't do that. That's the same runway. It's just the other way. They were absolutely fine post the hurricane. It was, if you looked out to sea, it was a traditional Caribbean day. It was absolutely fine.
We then go on to ask Lieutenant Bell about the story involved in the last Lynx cocaine bust, £40 million cocaine bust, when he was deployed in 2015 as the flight commander of 215 flight on RFA Wave Night on a Caribbean deployment.
You are acclaimed with the last narcotics bust on the Lynx. Was it a Mark 8?
That's correct. It was a Mark 8 Lynx on the penultimate deployment for the aircraft, right, after its career.
And where was this?
And this was in the Caribbean. Right. We've just come back from 6 months. We've been working in Royal Fleet Auxiliary Wave Nights, so a naval service vessel with a naval team on the back of it. I was the flight commander, and I had a team of maintainers and marines with me, and we did some dedicated counter-narcotics work out there.
Right, okay. And what was the mission on the day? What were you up to?
So this came up to the culmination of 2 months on the counter-narcotics profile. We're working under US jurisdiction, when we're out there.
Yeah.
And we had on board a United States Coast Guard team, a law enforcement detachment, and so we're working in concert with them.
Yeah.
So on the day the call came in, we were told through intelligence means that there was a suspicious vessel about 6 hours south of our ship.
Yeah.
So we made best speed towards that, and at a suitable range, we covertly launched the aircraft to go and search for the go-fast, as we call them.
Yeah.
And these vessels are commonly used for drug trafficking in the Caribbean. There'll be a high-powered speedboat, maybe with extra outboard engines on the back of the speedboat, and they're used to move the drugs from South America through the chain of islands towards the US mainland and onto Europe as well.
Yeah.
And so we got the call that there was a suspicious vessel. We used the sensors in the aircraft to locate that, and it was indeed a go-fast type. We had good intelligence from the Americans that it was carrying a decent amount of narcotics. And so we then proceeded through our process to attempt to stop the vessel.
Right, and how does one do that short of using weapons?
Well,
what we try and use at all times is minimal force.
Yeah.
And for this mission, the easiest way to get a ship to stop is simply ask it. So we got on the radio, we made contact with them as we were hovering next to the vessel and asked them to stop. They didn't do that, so we did some warning shots with our machine gun away from the vessel, but to show them that we meant business. Again, the five crew on the vessel ignored that. They kept on speeding toward land. And so then I got the authority to disable the vessel.
Right, okay.
And that involves my marine snipers, who are in the back of the aircraft. They're very highly trained. Not only are they snipers, qualified marine snipers, they then do a further qualification to qualify them to snipe from an airborne platform.
Yeah.
And they shot the engines out of the boat.
Wow.
Very precise marksmanship.
Yeah.
At no point was there any danger to the crew, who, as you can imagine, quite swiftly moved to the far end of the boat to stay out of the out of harm's way.
Yeah.
But they neglected to stop. We'd given them every chance.
Yeah.
And so we enforced that that hard stop, as we call it.
Right, okay. And what was the result of that bust? What did you manage to achieve?
Well, the US Coast Guards then came on scene in their small boats, searched the vessel. They'd... Before we actually stopped the vessel, they'd already started jettisoning some of the cocaine bales,
right.
And we could see those in the water.
Yeah.
So we knew that this was a suspect vessel, and we had very good grounds to stop it.
Yeah.
When we searched the vessel, there was over £40 million worth of cocaine,
wow.
Just under a metric ton of cocaine in the vessel itself.
Wow, wow. Well, thank you very much for that story, Rich.
A pleasure.
What's on the schedule for you now with the retirement of the Mark 8?
Well, as the Lynx goes out of service, I'll be staying on the squadron until March the 31st, when it's our out-of-service date. I'm very proud to be involved in the commemorations and the celebration. It's an aircraft type that I've been flying personally for over a decade.
Yeah.
And then for me next, it's going to be a ground tour. I'm on a staff appointment.
Right,
so
okay.
With increasing responsibility, comes a little bit less flying.
Yeah.
But I'm very much looking forward to coming back to the squadron after that
right.
to learn to fly the Wildcat, an immense new capability for us. But the Lynx has been such a stalwart servant over the past 10 years,
yeah.
and we really do have a bond with this aircraft. And it's shown itself with the drugs bust, with the hurricane relief that we were doing also out in the Caribbean, and the regional engagements. It really is still a very capable aircraft, despite its advancing years.
Yeah.
Next, we get to talk to Lieutenant Commander Joe Harper, Royal Navy Reserve. Started flying the Lynx in 1989 and has 6,500 hours on type. He's a flight observer. He's been a senior flight observer, the Chief Royal Navy Lynx Observer Instructor on naval flying standards, and has been the flight commander on HMS Daring during the Philippines disaster relief, which we'll hear a little bit more about now.
I'm with Lieutenant Commander Joe Harper, Royal Navy Reserve. Thank you very much, Lieutenant, for joining us.
Absolute pleasure.
What brings you here to Yeovilton today?
To come and see you guys, really, and to just talk about my experience with the Lynx helicopter over the years,
yeah.
and just to give you something to also some stories that you might wish to use.
Now, I've heard a few, and your name's come up quite a few times. I've heard one very exciting story about the good work you did down in the Philippines with the Lynx. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
The Philippines had the tragedy, and we were quite close by. We were around the Singapore area on board HMS Daring, and we were dispatched up to the Philippines to have a look at the situation and see what we could do to help the inhabitants. So we got up there and we did coastal searches and took a lot of film and a lot of pictures to try and assess which areas needed the most help.
Yeah.
And then for about 10 days afterwards, we just constantly putting in stores, putting in food, water, just to try and ease the situation for them. And we basically flew for about 8 to 10 hours per day for an entire week.
You flew something like 100 hours in a month or something.
Yes,
and that's quite challenging.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, and it's challenging not only for the air crew, because we only had one set of air crew, but it's also challenging for the maintainers as well. Because they have to maintain the aircraft. And thankfully, the aircraft just behaved magnificently.
Yeah. So tell us about your history with the Lynx. How many hours?
I've got 5,000 flying hours with the the Lynx, and I first started in 1989 with the Lynx.
Yeah.
Previous to that, I flew the Wasp helicopter.
Oh, the Wasp, great memories of the little Wasp.
Yeah.
Was that a big transition? I mean, technology-wise, the Lynx brought a lot of change, you know, with the rotor design, the engines, the power.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I was in the Wasp, but I was as an air crewman, a missile aimer as an air crewman. So I went from being a rating air crew, went through Dartmouth, became an officer, and then went on to the Lynx from there.
Right, okay.
So basically from 1989 right the way through until I retired in 2014, I've flown the Lynx.
Right, okay. Do you still fly, by the way?
No.
You not miss it?
No.
Why not? Hey? I've never heard that. Most people say, miss it, desperately, want to get out.
I've done my fair share. It's a young man's game, and I now drive trucks, and I like driving trucks.
Okay, so terra firma.
Yes.
Terra firma.
Yeah.
And what's your role in the reserve?
I'm in the Royal Navy Reserve Air Branch, and so I do a variety of jobs that are aviation-related.
Yeah.
For example, I go up to Scotland twice a year to do Exercise Joint Warrior, and I look after the helicopter taken up from trade, which supports the exercise. So I do all the operations for that.
Right. Okay. Okay. Let's come back to the Lynx then. What models have you flown? Have you flown them all?
Them all.
Any favourites?
The Mark III was the one I cut my teeth on.
Yeah.
And I always have a love of that aircraft. And then we went on to the Mark VIII, which was obviously technologically more advanced. Yeah. But I think the Mark III, it was a basic helicopter, and you just navigated it and operated it to the best of your ability with what you had.
Where else did you serve in the world?
I served all around the world. I did about 6 months out in the Caribbean, which sounds very, very nice, but we were basically doing counter-drugs operations.
Yeah.
And we had a highly successful 6 months, and about 100 tons of narcotics that we intercepted, and the Lynx helicopter was involved in every single drugs bust that the ship did.
Yeah.
And that was highly rewarding, but it was sort of 2 weeks at sea, flying every day, and then a weekend alongside to recuperate, and then back out again.
So tell us about the role of the observer then.
The observer, he basically fights the aircraft. Yeah. He navigates the aircraft, fights it. The pilot flies the aircraft.
Yeah.
That's his main role, and keeps us dry, keeps us out of the water.
And what sort of changes have you seen over the last sort of 20, 30 years in the Lynx in terms of its capabilities to fight?
Well, it has become more and more capable as the years have gone on, and the role of it has increased tremendously.
Yeah.
So we're going from basic firing of missiles, and then we're going into load lifting, winching, doing different roles like anti-drugs, doing maritime counter-terrorism, all these sorts of things that are just basically making the aircraft more and more capable, really. Yeah.
And what would you say to some of the youngsters who are thinking about coming into a career like this? You had a long career with the Navy. Yeah. Looking back, what sort of advice and guidance can you give to people thinking about a career?
If they want a career in the Royal Navy, it is the best career that you can have. I did 38 years. I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it. And from the day I joined, I realised that I actually found a job that I really, really like, and therefore I never worked another day in my life, basically.
Well, enjoy driving your trucks.
I will.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Next, we get to speak to Lucky Al, Lieutenant Commander Al Reed, MBE, Royal Navy Reserve. Started flying the Lynx in 1988 and has about 3,500 to 4,000 hours on type. Awarded the MBE in the 2016 New Year's Honours list. Currently, he's on his fifth appointment at 815 Squadron, six if you count the Royal Navy Reserve separately. Many, many other roles, but let's find out why he's called Lucky Owl.
Why Lucky Owl?
Right, so in 1982, I took over as the training officer on the Lynx Training Squadron, 702, and part of the training officer's duties was to run a pairs helicopter display.
Right.
On the first practice of the pairs helicopter display, I actually overlapped rotors with the formation leader, took about 3 foot off the end of all the blades for the two helicopters. So he landed in a field 4 miles from Portland.
Yeah.
I landed in another field about 3 miles from Portland. And I then had to be the training officer of a squadron with two helicopters missing for about 12 months.
Right, okay, so pretty popular.
Yeah, and it got a bit more complicated than that because I then, shortly after that, went to work for the Air Force and my rented house that they'd given me tried to burn itself down twice in 24 hours. So that's where the Lucky Owl came.
Right,
so it was
okay.
cemented in time with the same fire crew trying to put my house out twice.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh, okay. Yeah. Are we okay here? Is there anything near us that's going to...
No.
You've got a reputation. For...
Yes, just a bit. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the Lynx. What time have you got on the Lynx?
I've got about 4,000 hours flying Lynx. I've been here on and off since 1989.
Right.
Just looked in the logbook. That's when I qualified. And I, in the meantime, have done one job at Shorebury on the Squirrel and the Griffin.
Yeah.
One job at Shorebury on the Gazelle, and one desk job at Abbey Wood. The rest of the time since 1989, I've been here or hereabouts. So the squadron's moved, but I've moved with it a few times.
And I suppose with the retirement of the Lynx, what's Lucky Owl do next?
Well, Lucky Owl retired 2 years ago.
Right. Okay.
But because lots of Lynx air crew are now qualifying on the Wildcat.
Right.
Lucky Owl can come to work 2 days a week.
Okay.
And continue to fly the Lynx because I'm not cross-training because I'm far too old. So I retired on my 55th birthday because that's what the Navy does.
Yeah.
But since then, I've kept fully current. I don't do anything else but come into work, brief and fly. So I fly normally twice a day, Mondays and Tuesdays.
Right, okay. And is that instructing or just...
Yeah, I do some instruction.
Yeah.
But I'm on... have you heard of MCT?
No.
Maritime Counterterrorism. We have a commitment to that.
Team.
And I'm part of the team that's on call to do that most of the time.
So what's the role of that team?
That is, it's counterterrorism. It's exactly what it says on the tin, really.
Yeah.
So we do the bit that if you have to go and visit somebody at sea rather than visit them at land, over the land.
Right.
So.
Okay, all right. Say no more secret squirrel.
Yeah, so I take a number of gentlemen who I don't know the name of wherever they want to go because that seems polite at the time.
Where have you served with the Lynx?
So I was flight commander on a Type 21, active just for a little while, covering for somebody else. I was on a Leander class frigate, which is wooden decks and all the rest of it for 2 years, and then I ran
ethics model time
directorate of naval recruiting flight for 2 years, which was going around the countryside doing flying displays, so two schools a day, flying the kids and doing a display at each school, and in the summer I did county shows and flew the Royal Marines parachute display team.
Right. Okay.
And I did a little bit of 30 seconds of display, and that's all they gave me. We just go around the country and do manage two counter shows, the middle week, middle of the week, and the weekends.
And we talked a little bit about flying the aircraft. What is it like to fly?
It's like, well, the Mark 8 definitely is like the sporty version of, it's like a Focus ST-170 instead of the bog standard. Family version. In terms of all the other aircraft I've flown, it's the most responsive, probably the most powerful when it's only got half a tank of gas and there's only two people in it. The fastest, it's very manoeuvrable, lovely aircraft to display in.
Yeah.
Better than its Mark 3, despite the fact that it's much heavier.
Right.
It's more solid. So it was the whole airframe was designed to have the power it's got. So, which is why I say an ST, so it's like the suspension matches the engine performance.
Right.
Whereas the Mark III Lynx was a bit like a 1250 Mini, which was with drum brakes. It was a great aeroplane, but
going around left-hand corners when you're full of fuel was not the easiest thing in the world to do.
And what about at sea? We've talked to some pilots already today about those terrible deck landings. How about learning those first time out? What was that like?
I think the Lynx is slightly more difficult to do deck landings on than the Sea King, because the Sea King, you move the controls and half a second later things start to happen. Okay. Whereas the Lynx, it's pretty instant.
Yeah, responsive.
But it does mean that it's very easy to put in the right place if you don't hang about.
Right.
So it's not too bad.
And a favourite memory then?
Favourite memory? I think I ran the Black Cats display team in 2008. Right. Yep. Well, far too old as a 48-year-old. And I did one display, which I think I got everything right. Everything right for 7 minutes. Beautiful day, no wind, lovely audience, lots of good photographs from the amateur photographers, and I think one in a year of probably 50 was an absolutely perfect display, so that's a standout moment for me.
Well, thank you very much for your service and thanks for joining us.
Cheers, thank you very much.
Okay, it's at this point that I got a very special opportunity. The Royal Navy had arranged with the RAF to provide a flight ship to photograph two remaining Lynx in air. Now, obviously, being an audio programme, there wasn't much of an opportunity to do a great deal of recording on the aircraft, so I've got to say I was thoroughly spoilt by going up in the Chinook. A great aircraft, wonderful to fly in. The aircraft we flew in, 707, I think it was, had extended fuel tanks in, so slightly limited space inside, but much quieter than I thought it would be, given how they sound from the outside. Wonderful, wonderful experience. I flew with some great photographers and videographers who hung out the back to take some photos of the Lynx Mark 8s. We'll include one or two in the show notes, probably from our good friend Lee Howard, who took an awful lot of time out the back of that aircraft, and good luck to him. It certainly wasn't something for me. Flying over the Somerset and Dorset countryside was just quite amazing. A couple of hundred feet with the two Mark 8 Lynx flying along beside us. It was something very, very special, and I'm very, very grateful to all the team for arranging that. And just shows the interdepartment cooperation between the RAF and the Royal Navy. So thank you very much for allowing me to go along on that flight. Okay, after that flight had landed and I'd recovered myself, I went back into the briefing room and got an opportunity to record another discussion with Commander Gus Carney, who of course is the Force Commander, a little bit about his experience on the Lynx.
So how many hours have you got?
1,500 hours on type. I will always be a Lynx operator. I'm Wildcat now as well, but it's still a little bit alien to a 40-year-old like me.
Yeah. How have your times flying the Lynx? Is there any particular shorties or period that's...
Yeah, so I was very lucky is the wrong word to use. I did overland operations in 2003 with the Lynx. I did the evacuations of Lebanon with HMS Gloucester, so I was the flight pilot of that, flying the missions into Lebanon to pick both people up and drop specialist operators back in, which was a real real experience. My wife wasn't so happy because she was giving birth at the time, but I managed to mess that one up in her view, but I was having lots of fun. Then two other operations I've done, particularly note, I did a hostage rescue in Eritrea, and I did a merchantman retake in Somalia back in 2006 with the Americans, and was, to my knowledge, the first and maybe the last British asset that was allowed inside Somalia to operate with the Americans and retake a merchantman, which was a great night for every aviator.
Step me into a Lynx. Did you always feel, you know, what was your personal feeling getting into it? You know, obviously, that, you know, we see a lot landing back the ships and things like that. I mean, do you feel, I mean, people say it's like a glove fit, and obviously it's a different sort of feel. I mean, is there any sort of
I mean, I've gone through a torturous process to get here. I joined up as a lad. I was a warfare officer, so I navigated ships.
Yeah.
And I didn't, you know, I never really, if I'm completely honest, and I shouldn't say in front of aviation fans, I never really had the want to fly.
my captain at the time was an aviator, and he put me forward for flying training without my knowledge. It's the first time I knew, as he said, when he said, "Congratulations, you're off to flying training," which I didn't know I was going to do. And I never looked back really from there. I was supposed to be one of these guys that went back and drove ships. Once you've got one of these, I don't know why you don't want to. Then, the flip side, we've said guys the other way, which I treat as my quid pro quo, really. That I've stayed doing the job I love. This is, in my opinion, the only way to fly. Two crew up front, fighting an aircraft side by side, without a whole bunch of people talking to you from the back or telling you what to do. Because, like most pilots, are quite selfish, and I like to do what I want to do. This is still and it will always be the sports car of generations. As long as I don't think a military aircraft will ever break its speed records. From the Lynx,
you're working quite hard, aren't you? The left hand seat, I mean, the right hand seat, the pilot is generally more flying the aircraft.
Yeah, I have the fun job of making the observer's life difficult by going the wrong way when he tells me to turn left. Yeah. I mean, and I have a pilot's brain, which you can tell me which heading to steer, and two seconds later I've forgotten. But the Lynx is, you're so close to each other, you don't really have to worry. And the crews I've been crewed up with, I'm very lucky. My observers have all been very good and very patient. And after a month at sea, you can go through a 2-hour sortie without talking, because you know exactly what the other person is thinking. I don't think many other crews within a military flying environment get that kind of that liaison. And I'm just coming back now, so in sort of perspective, the next CO of 815 was my flight commander.
Yeah.
The next CO of 825 was my flight observer. So you get that kind of really close link between yourselves. And we're going to be very lucky to be in charge of this whole growing force together, as guys who flew together.
And actually, you know, flying the Lynx, is there one particular factor that, you know, stands out to you? Obviously, you know, it seems a very durable aircraft, as well as obviously speed.
Well, a bit of everything. From a pilot's perspective, it is a sports car. You can turn it on its nose, you can turn it upside down, it'll do everything you want it to, and it'll never let you down. I've had a few times I've lost engines on it, but it flies you home anyway.
It's always very confident.
Yeah, never thought at all that I'd be falling out of the sky at any point. Although, you know, I've in my career lost at least 7 of my oppos to the Lynx, so it's quite, you know, it does eat people if you get it wrong. But the other side of it is I'm very lucky to have fired the skewer on many occasions as well, and just that feeling of a proper heavyweight missile dropping off your aircraft and then going to destroy a target is quite a sensation when you're a naval aviator, because for 10 years Afghanistan everyone was quite happy shooting another bit of cannons and hellfires, but we were sort of steep blows up on the sea skewers.
But that'd be quite a change in the field, won't it, going from 3.3 ton aircraft to something, as you say, that's
and it is different. It is completely different. It doesn't stop as quickly.
And
I was saying to some of the guys earlier that it's like the worst parent as well, because it doesn't stop you from doing anything. But it tells on you when you do.
Oh, really?
Because it's got full HUMS integration in it as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And it won't let you do anything without telling your dad that you've done it. So that is quite restraining. Because some of these manoeuvres we fly, and particularly Ruskin invertees, you're coming from a Lynx and you're doing engine off landings, or you're doing general handling practice, you throw it around a corner in the way it used to fly a Lynx around a corner. Now, firstly, it's nearly a ton heavier, so it doesn't like it. Yeah. And B, you land on and it screams at you with blue captions to tell you that you've been naughty. And then, as I say, it tells the engineers you've been naughty, and you have to explain yourself, even at my level.
Interesting.
So I'm afraid that we're going to get lost time. Okay, so this will continue on now. This capability is so far ahead of the Lynx. But the Lynx will never be forgotten, because it still happens in the fleet in many other navies. And I think the records that Lynx has set over its 40-odd years flying just means it'll never be forgotten about.
One last question. What's happening to the remaining airframes? Are they going to Wallop or somewhere for...
There's quite a lot. Most of them have been stripped down anyway, because a lot of what you see on that aircraft is no different. Sponsons, wheels, nose, rotor head blades, etc. are all from the Lynx donor programme. But the rest of them are up in St Athan, being stripped down for parts. And will be some of the airframes will be, so you can buy one off from DD&S if you want one in your back garden for about $8,000. So I'm getting there quickly. We'll turn it into one of these hotels like everybody else seems to be doing, B&Bs.
And finally, I got to speak to my good friend Elfan at Reese, who of course is involved with the helicopter museum as well. What he thought about the retirement of the Lynx.
Alfin, thanks for joining us. We've seen all about the Lynx today. What does the Lynx mean to you?
Incredible aircraft when it was first introduced, of course. The first real, what I would call, small ship helicopter. The Navy had sort of started off on the Wasp, which was a predecessor, but the Lynx was a huge advance in technology.
Yeah.
And I'm fortunate that I've seen it all the way through its life.
And you get visitors to the helicopter museum, and the Lynx has been a regular. Tell us about an airframe that you've got at the museum.
Well, of course, we've got the world speed record holder. One of the Lynxes was modified for a speed record attempt in 1986, and it still holds the speed record today.
And tell us about the helicopter museum then. Where are you and what can we see?
The helicopter museum's at Weston-super-Mare. It's got the world's largest collection of helicopters, and there's everything there from 1930s right up to the present day.
Okay then, and a final thought for the Lynx today?
So sorry to see it going out of service.
And what about the Wildcat? It's very exciting.
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the Wildcat is the next generation, has a lot of the Lynx attributes in it, but of course newer technology, so another step forward.
Okay, well, I hope you've enjoyed that brief coverage of the event we attended just over a week ago now. And, of course, there's still some opportunity to see the Lynx fly in before it does go out of service, but they are very limited now. So I think there are one or two you might get the opportunity to see down at HMS Heron. Okay, a big thank you to Andy Jackson and Tracy Clemson for arranging this event and for supporting Extended in this publication. And of course, a very big thank you to Commander Phil Richardson and Commander Gus Carney for inviting us down to 815 Squadron at HMS Heron. We had a fantastic time. I hope you've enjoyed this coverage. This is Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
How easy was it to fly? Helicopters are always a bit confusing to us non-qualified pilots.
Yeah.
Ups and downs and lefts and rights and that sort of thing. But I haven't heard anyone say it's a tricky aircraft to fly.
Well, I found it very tricky because I'm not a pilot, I'm an observer.
Oh, okay.
So whenever I was sort of given the controls, it was all very much sort of out of control, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I couldn't do it.
No, nor could I.
I'm a drummer, but I can't rub my stomach. Yeah.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.